Folks, have you checked out the Irish History Podcast shop recently? Right now, I have a sale of 30% off everything when you use the code SALE30. So go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and get 30% off everything when you use the discount code SALE30.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you think of daily life in the Middle Ages, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Maybe it's the shockingly low life expectancy. Perhaps it's the violence, the rampant disease, or the lack of hygiene. I think we all share stereotypes that conjure up a world where people struggled to survive. In this podcast, Professor Eileen Murphy from Queen's University Belfast shares groundbreaking new insights into life in the Middle Ages based on analysis of hundreds of bodies excavated from a medieval cemetery in Ranelagh, County Roscommon. She'll answer any questions you might have about what life in the Middle Ages was like, but I would say prepare to be surprised. I'm pretty sure no matter how difficult you thought medieval life was, you'll still be shocked by Eileen's findings. This episode is certainly not for the faint of heart. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer. Now I'm going to dive right into today's episode. It's definitely one of my favourites of the year so far, and I'm pretty confident you're going to love it too. If you want to find out more about what me and Eileen are talking about today, the book that contains all her findings and analysis is available online, and it's actually free to read online. I have a link to it in the show notes below. It's a really accessible book. You don't need to be an expert to understand it at all. I really enjoyed it, and as I say, I think you will too. So I have links to that in the show notes below. Sound on today's episode is by Kate Dunley. Given the episode is about life in the Middle Ages, and the early Middle Ages in particular, I thought it'd be worth getting Eileen to explain exactly what time period we're talking about before we get into the nitty-gritty of life at the time. I think medieval or Middle Ages is a term that can mean very different things to different people.
The early medieval period is really from when Christianity started in Ireland. So it would be kind of from the 5th century. You know, from sort of early 5th century, and it would last up until the arrival of the Anglo-Normans, so in the early 12th century. So at this time, I suppose that the landscape would have been dominated by sort of different dynasties. They would have lived in what are called tuatha. People who would have been living in ring forts or raths, which we see dotted around the countryside. You know, these are one of the most sort of common monuments that we see on the landscape. But sites like Ranelagh seem to maybe have started off as an ordinary rath type site, but then kind of evolved into something that was more like an assembly site or a communal type site, you know, used by lots of people.
Eileen is going to share a lot of detail about day-to-day life based around an excavation at Ranelagh outside Roscommon town. Now, this site had been lost for centuries, but archaeologists uncovered it during roadworks. Eileen explains now how it was rediscovered.
In terms of the actual archaeological site at Ranelagh, it had disappeared from history. And it was only really when the road schemes started that that's when it was rediscovered. So basically what seems to have happened was that there's a very dangerous bend in the road. So they set out to straighten that road, and there was no idea that there was, you know, a major archaeological site at this location when they were doing their sort of trial excavations and archival investigations. You know, they noticed sort of shape that the field was quite curvilinear, and then subsequently they discovered burials and then realised there was a major site here that had been sort of lost to history.
The first step after its rediscovery was an excavation. Eileen is going to explain now what the archaeologists found, but it's important to acknowledge the large team involved in the project at this point. So the excavations were directed by Shane Delaney from Irish Archaeological Consultancy, and Martin Jones was the project manager for Transport Infrastructure Ireland, who funded the project with Roscommon County Council. Eileen now takes up the story, explaining how they found a massive array of artefacts, basically the remains of a pretty busy medieval settlement.
So in Queens, we were responsible for looking at the burials, but the wealth of other information that was found on the site, you know, yielded a huge amount of information, you know, about what life was like at the site. And it seems to have started off fairly small and, you know, just maybe a small group of people, but gradually over time, more and more people, like a community, were using the site. And there seems to have been a lot of industrial processes taking place on the site, you know, like metalworking, breeding and rearing of livestock, and then obviously the butchery of livestock, and a lot of industrial processes, you know, involved, you know, animal bone and antler and skins. But there was evidence of metalworking. Seems to have been a very busy place. And, you know, in terms of day-to-day life, there's evidence that they were processing grains and even brewing. You know, the way some of the plant remains have been processed suggestive, you know, of beer brewing. So that kind of is the background then in which we're studying the human remains.
Eileen and her team in Queen's University Belfast analysed the human remains in incredible detail. As we turned to her findings, she began by explaining the people buried at Ranelagh were not as healthy as you might expect. The archaeologists had found evidence of a wide variety of foodstuffs, but this was only part of the picture.
So you would think that because of all the sort of animal remains that probably they had a fairly good diet, you know, and also all the plant remains. But one of the striking things about the people at Ranelagh was that there was a high level of, you know, children aged less than 1 year. So we can kind of divide the population of about 557 people into thirds. So a third were under one, third between 1 and 18, and then a third were adults. And the babies seemed to be very frail and very sickly. And they were the ones who were suffering from, you know, malnutrition and diseases like rickets and scurvy.
This left Eileen with an overall picture of a people struggling in a harsh world.
I do think that they were living in a very difficult environment, and it could have been climatic downturns. And, you know, in the annals, we get records of, you know, persistent snow and darkness. Obviously, they're just focusing in on really extreme weather conditions, but I think probably there was like a low-lying kind of poor weather and inclement, you know, problematic environments a lot of the time.
Some of the clearest indicators of this difficult life was the evidence of scurvy and rickets on the human remains.
So in terms of scurvy, it seemed to really affect the very young babies up until about 9 months of age. And what I think might have been happening was that the mothers were very malnourished, and for a baby to survive, the best chance was to be able to breastfeed. So I think if the malnourished mothers were breastfeeding their baby, they might have been, you know, giving them enough nutrition through that. They may have been supplementing the feeding with, you know, animal milk. And we know, again, from historic sources that they did a lot of strange things to milk. You know, they were boiling animal milk and diluting it. And possibly if they were doing this to milk that was then fed to babies, that would further, you know, deplete vitamin C. And if the weather was very bad, you know, they weren't going to have lovely vegetables and fruit and other things to keep people well nourished. The baby's health seems to have improved around sort of 9 months of age. And we know from stable isotopes, which can tell us about diet, that breastfeeding seems to have kind of ended around sort of 6 months, and that other types of foods were then being introduced to the diet. So that's why I think it's to do with kind of child rearing practices and maternal health. Rickets is a bit different. So rickets is vitamin D deficiency, and it requires sunlight. So this is why, again, I think the environment played a part, you know, in terms of dark conditions. So if there was bad weather, it would be natural to keep maybe the most vulnerable members of society indoors. So like the pregnant women and their babies. So maybe this is, you know, if the babies were sickly because of scurvy deficiency, they were keeping them indoors to protect them. But then that just led on to vitamin D deficiency. And quite a lot of the babies had both vitamin C and D deficiency. So I think if they survived infancy, they tended to go on to live to middle age. But infancy was a real challenge at Ranelagh.
One of the most common perceptions about the medieval world is that people in the Middle Ages lived very short lives. I asked Eileen about this and what life expectancy was for someone who did manage to survive those very difficult early years.
With adult aging techniques, it's quite difficult. In osteoarchaeology, our methods are quite blunt. So we tend to divide people into young, middle and old adults. So young would be sort of 18 to 35, middle 35 to 50, and then shockingly old is over 50. But at Ranelagh, most people were getting into the middle age category. You know, so they were sort of 35 to 50, which is a pretty good age for an archaeological population. Like another population I've studied from Ballyhanna in County Donegal, they were a later medieval population, but most of the adults died quite young. They died in the younger category. So they must have been even more stressed in other, you know, different ways to what was happening at Ranelagh.
Another common idea many of us have is that medieval people were short. So I asked Eileen about average height at the time. I think it's fair to say people were actually a bit taller than we might expect.
I think people were probably a couple of inches shorter on average to what we would have today. But it's all tied into nourishment and to how physiologically stressed they were. So I think at Ranelagh, the average height for a woman was about 5'3", whereas in modern Ireland, it's about 5'5". And for men, it was about 5'7", whereas in modern Ireland, it's about 5'10". You do get some people who are very little, like there was one adult woman who was about 4'6", you know, so she would have been pretty tiny. But then you get a lot of tall people and you get men, you know, plenty of people in their 6-footers as well. So I think it's diverse, but there does seem to be a gradual trend for people getting taller, but that's because diet is improving. You know, and that seems to be just, that's an accepted trend. Ranelagh is not really very different to other medieval populations.
Next, we went on to talk about the genome analysis carried out on the human remains. Now, this is something I have very little understanding of, but what Eileen and her team could glean from about the 20 individuals involved in this part of the study was just incredible. Through genome analysis, they were able to reconstruct what the people of Ranelagh looked like, including their hair and eye colour. As you're about to hear, the early medieval population in Ranelagh were more diverse than I think most of us would expect.
As part of the Ranelagh project, we were really fortunate to collaborate with the geneticists in Trinity College Dublin. So we were working with Dr. Lara Cassidy. So we had about, I think it was about 20 people or so, had their full genomes analysed. And this can give a really good picture, you know, of that person's sort of, you know, health in terms of genetic diseases, but it can also tell about their pigmentation. Just in general terms, I think pale to sort of intermediate skin colour was the most common, but you had the full range, you know, people who were very fair to people who were quite dark skinned. I think light brown hair was sort of in the predominance, but then there were a smaller number of people who would have been redheads or had black hair or even pale blonde. And then in terms of eye colour, which I must admit, I was quite surprised. The majority, I think over 50%, had brown eyes. And then there was a big chunk had blue eyes and a few had sort of intermediate eye colour. It really helps to bring back the people. You know, you're not just looking at their bones. You're able to, you know, talk about particular individuals.
Genome analysis combined with other tests can also indicate where people buried at Ranelagh came from. It determined whether they were local to the area or not. This led to one intriguing finding. One person buried there had come a long way, or certainly had travelled further than I think we would imagine people were travelling at this point in history.
One burial that really stood out to me was, it was this old woman. She was buried with her knees raised up in front of her and her arms crossed over her chest. So we knew there was something a bit unusual about her. When we looked at her dietary isotopes, it suggested that she'd eaten a lot of fish in childhood, which was a bit strange because she was the only person who had that profile. We looked at her lead isotopes, and as you'd expect for rural Ireland, most people had very little lead in their body, but she had high lead content, which suggests that she'd maybe grown up in a town or somewhere very polluted, you know, due to an industry. Then her DNA profile actually looked continental Europe, you know, so it was kind of, it was a real outlier compared to, you know, what the other people who looked more local to the Ranelagh area. And then the final thing was her strontium and oxygen isotopes, which is another way we can determine whether people are local or non-local to an area. And hers showed really definite parallels with people over in Northern England and Yorkshire. Looking at the DNA and the strontium and oxygen, it suggests she was probably an Anglo-Saxon woman who had, for whatever reason, ended up buried at Ranelagh. So, you know, that just sort of shows the power of the genetics.
Eileen and her team were even able to reconstruct the allergies people at Ranelagh had. These must have had a huge bearing on life, particularly, as Eileen now explains, because people wouldn't have understood what was wrong with them.
You know, we were able to look and see there was one poor woman who was lactose intolerant, which would have been horrific living in a dairying economy. And she probably wouldn't have really realised why she was feeling so unwell a lot of the time, you know, when she drank milk. We had other people who were identified as carriers of hemochromatosis, which is a very common disease today in modern Irish people and causes overloading of iron. So I think they were just carriers, but they could have, you know, potentially had offspring with the full-blown disease.
Often analysis and discussion around people buried over 1,000 years ago presents them as artifacts or objects rather than people who had feelings like you and I do today. Eileen, however, has been able to glean evocative images of the relationships the people who lived, died and were buried at Ranelagh had.
And we had a couple of double burials. So these are where two people maybe died simultaneously and were buried together. We were able to look at the relationships of those individuals. So in one case, there were two little children. There was a little boy and a slightly older girl. I think she was about seven and a half to nine and a half. And she was basically buried hugging the little boy. So there's obviously was some tragedy that caused those two children to die. Now, it was invisible in their skeleton, so whether it was like an infectious disease that carried them off really quickly or some accident that's invisible to us today. The genetics showed that they were, I think it was first cousins once removed. So they were related, you know, there was a kind of a family connection there. And, you know, again, you could just imagine the sort of the parents maybe being connected and then being heartbroken when these children died. And I just think the way the little girl's hugging the little boy is very poignant. And maybe she looked after him when they were alive. And then in the afterlife, maybe the idea was that she would still sort of take care of him, you know. But these little glimpses of humanity are what make it really worthwhile for me.
Now, as someone who hates going to the dentist, the next part of our conversation was one that made me shudder. Teeth, in general, can be a really rich source of evidence for archaeologists. And at Ranelagh, Eileen looked into the teeth of the people. Now, they were terrible. I let Eileen explain, but some of the toothaches they had could even kill.
Medieval people really would have generally had pretty horrendous teeth. And I always think, you know, showing kids pictures of medieval teeth is probably a very good sort of public health warning, you know, to brush your teeth and look after your teeth. So a lot of the people at Ranelagh would have had caries. So these are holes in their teeth, you know, caused by tooth decay. And that would be just simply from their diet. So they would have eaten quite a lot of cereals and they would have, you know, the sort of sugars in cereals would have been cariogenic and caused decay. They also had lots of calculus. So this is basically mineralized plaque and it builds up in the teeth. If you don't brush your teeth, sometimes your teeth feel a bit furry. So if you never brush your teeth, it builds up into this kind of hard concretion. And again, it sort of depends on diet. You know, if they're eating lots of proteins and meats and milks, then that would allow that to build up. There was one old woman and the levels of calculus on her teeth, they were about an inch long on the back of her lower teeth. And I just imagine like if she put her tongue down in her mouth, she'd been feeling these lumps and it must have been really horrible and annoying. She let it stay for whatever reason. But we get a sense that sort of levels of dental hygiene were probably quite low and people just, it was just part of life, they just tolerated it.
And did people clean their teeth at all or is there any evidence of people cleaning their teeth?
I don't think there's really any evidence, you know, but then what they would have been using maybe their finger or maybe a bit of a piece of bark or something. That just, you don't really get a sense that it was a big concern for them. Caries cause basically tooth decay, which then can go down into the root of the tooth and end up with a dental abscess, which, you know, thankfully, like today, a lot of us would kind of go to the dentist before something like that occurred. But they'd have had these like serious infections in their mouths because of abscesses. And, you know, we know from looking at some of the historical sources for sort of later medieval times that dental abscesses would have been a major cause of death, you know, because of the infection sort of in your head. And hard to believe.
So that would lead to sepsis, is it?
Well, it could if it was sort of big enough and untreated. I mean, I've seen abscesses that go into the nasal cavity, and some abscesses go into the palate. So you could just, you know, you're kind of close to your brain and to a lot of vital, you know, vital parts of your system in your mouth. So, and it can also, you know, tooth decay, even modern clinicians talk about tooth decay having an impact on the heart and on other parts of the body, you know, in a negative way. So if these people kind of had all these conditions chronically, it must have taken its toll, not to mention the pain if you had a toothache, and even the smell from the bad breath and everything. It must have been pretty horrific.
Every single detail of these bodies offered up new insights. For example, Eileen was able to use the presence of infection and disease to reconstruct aspects of life, including just how dirty day-to-day life was at the time.
There were quite high levels of infection in the lower legs amongst the Ranelagh people. And I think this was sort of amongst, you know, adults and children. And maybe it gives us an insight into, you know, maybe they were going barefooted quite a lot, which is sort of what we'd expect. And just, you know, that their lower legs were exposed to sort of being bumped and banged and maybe then getting infection. You know, we know from other sort of types of archaeological evidence that their living conditions were pretty unhygienic. You know, their places like Deer Park Farm in County Antrim, the houses inside a ring fort were excavated, and there was, you know, lots of evidence of sort of parasites like fleas and lice and things, and kind of damp, mouldy beds. So if you're sort of living in conditions like that, you know, you potentially would be picking up infections. And I think as well, you get lots of evidence for sort of chest infections, because again, the houses would have been maybe sort of dark and dank and quite smoky, because they wouldn't really have had, you know, windows, you know, and mostly like a central hearth and the door.
Broken bones was also another great insight into life. Eileen has been able to analyse bone injuries and extrapolate what this would have reflected about day-to-day life. Like, if you break a certain type of bone, this might be related to what you work at.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
We know in Irish early medieval society, there was quite a gendered labour division. So we find this through the patterns of injury that males would have lots of sort of fractures of their long bones. So maybe they were out, you know, away from the domestic environment, you know, engaged in sort of farming activities and out, you know, building bridges or building houses or whatever, and falling off and having these big injuries. Whereas women were sort of more in the domestic environment, and they tend to have quite a lot of like fractures in their fingers. And I just wonder, is that to do with sort of finer working? And then we get this pattern sort of replicated almost in arthritis. You know, and again, we can see kind of the gendered sort of labour divisions coming through in different areas of arthritis in the body between males and females. Just going back to health, I suppose, tuberculosis seems to have been a big problem for early medieval Irish people. And you know, at most sites you get a couple of cases of people with tuberculosis, but at Ranelagh, I think there was about 10 individuals. So that was about 3%, which is a bit higher than you'd normally find in other cemetery populations. And that's only the tip of the iceberg, because a lot of times people would have tuberculosis and it doesn't affect their bones. So we're only seeing a small amount. That would have been a very debilitating disease. And again, the person's body would be racked with kind of abscess cavity, you know, abscesses in their spine and all across their body. And there was one adolescent woman who really sort of stuck out to me, because she had these massive cavities in her lower legs. So they would have been, you know, again, sort of weeping sores in her lower legs and in her ribs and lots of other parts of her body. But she also had one in her jawbone. You know, it had been very much eroded by the disease. So she'd been chronically ill. She'd have had these abscesses, and then she'd have had this facial disfigurement, which I kind of think would have also taken its toll on her psychologically. But she was buried in a very particular way, and her knees were sort of up in front of her, but her hands were kind of in a prayer position right in front of her mouth. And I just wonder, was there like a particularly deep connection between whoever buried her and, you know, her during life, and they wanted to kind of put her into like a prayer position to maybe give her a chance at sort of happiness in the afterlife, because she would have had a really tough life trying to endure this disease, probably from younger childhood, you know, and through until she died as a teenager.
So far, we've talked a lot about medieval life and the many injuries and diseases people suffered with. This left me wondering what the people looked like. Did they bear the marks of these diseases and injuries in their appearance? Basically, what would they have looked like if you could travel back to medieval Ranelagh?
I get a sense that these people, you know, probably life was so tough. A lot of it would have been survival. You know, you'd have been going through the cycles of the year, but always with kind of trying to make sure you had enough food, enough shelter, you know, that your family could survive. A lot of the children showed evidence of stunted growth, which is a sort of, again, a sign that they would have had, you know, been living with a lot of environmental pressures. And I was quite struck. We were comparing the medieval Irish populations to some of the sort of industrial populations. I think it was either Liverpool or Manchester, some of the big industrial towns. And the medieval Irish children were smaller than those little, you know, the little kids who'd have been working in kind of, you know, if you think about Dickens and the factories and the Industrial Revolution. And we all think of those like little sort of street urchins and how tough life would have been for them, you know, working in these factories. And you could just, you know, the pictures of them as like little scrawny creatures, you know, very emaciated. And then the Irish, the medieval children were sort of smaller. You can imagine they were probably, you know, even more sort of emaciated and small, and because life was really hard. So I mean, we're all well nourished and well, you know, I imagine most of us in Ireland were fortunate enough to be relatively well nourished compared to what medieval people would have experienced, because we generally have a fairly ready supply of good nutrients, you know, in our diet, but those people wouldn't. It would have been precarious enough existence.
Everything in our conversation so far indicated life always veered uncomfortably close to death. Next, we moved on to discuss violence. Maybe this is the part of our conversation that surprised me most. I would have assumed there was a lot of evidence of violence on the remains analysed from Ranelagh, but what surprised me is how rare it was. It was certainly more common than today, but in the wider scheme of things, it was still pretty rare.
I think a lot of past societies get kind of labelled with being very violent and highly violent. But then when you sort of look at the osteoarchaeological evidence, that's not necessarily the case. And a lot of times it's the elite who are involved in sort of violence. And if you think about it, the elite are the people who are normally documented historically. So it's their stories that are being told. And that's one of the beauties of archaeology and osteoarchaeology, that we can bring in the lives of the ordinary people who are, you know, invisible quite often in the historical records. Dr. Colm Donnelly and I, we did a study just comparing sort of general early violence in early medieval and later medieval Ireland. And we found that it was a bit more violent in early medieval times, but it still was a fairly small percent. You know, we just looked at the number of individuals with violent death compared to the number who didn't.
I asked Eileen for a percentage, basically how many people were dying violent deaths. I was surprised at how low it was.
it's tiny. It's only like, I think it was about 3% or something. It's very, you know, it's a very small proportion.
Now, while violent deaths were rarer than you might expect, those who did die violently suffered wounds that were far worse than you might imagine. Now, some of our conversations now are on the graphic side, so if you have little ears around, you might want to slip on the headphones at this point.
At Ranelagh, we did find some quite horrific examples of violence. So I think there were 7 male individuals with evidence of violent death. You know, so these are people who had died, you know, at the hand of, you know, at the end of a sword or some big sharp force weapon. 5 of these individuals had been decapitated, so it looked like they were formal executions, because the nature of the injuries that we could see suggested that they would have had their heads bent forward and then the blows were dealt from behind. Now, unfortunately, it wasn't like a clean cut in quite a number of the cases. It was pretty botched, you know, and there were maybe 3 or 4 attempts to actually remove the head. So that's pretty grim in itself.
There was also pretty awful mutilations of bodies as well. Again, a warning, this stuff is pretty graphic.
There were 2 individuals as well who actually looked like they'd been really mutilated. So there was one guy, he'd clearly been decapitated, but then it looked like they kind of set upon his chest, because there were all these like different cuts on his ribs, his pelvic bones, and it looked like they were trying to basically get at the organs underneath, you know, and maybe remove his heart and his lungs and organs from the abdomen. And there was even cuts in around the sort of the lower part of the pelvic bones and the upper leg bones. And I think maybe that was like genital removal. So it was all to do with sort of mutilation. He'd had his throat stabbed and looked like there was almost like puncturing, trying to sort of cut the, you know, the blood vessels in the neck. So I think they really went to town on him.
In some cases, mutilations like this were actually carried out not to humiliate a person, but rather as part of a spiritual ritual. This doesn't appear to have been the case at Ranelagh.
Now, we know that in medieval times, some high status people wanted bits of their bodies to be buried in different places, you know, because of status and attachment. And I think it's supposed to improve their chances in the afterlife, but I'm not quite sure how that worked. But for this guy, I think his is too much about mutilation. You know, it looks like he was badly treated and abused. You know, the body was being abused. And it's not uncommon. Like, there's a few other examples like this in Ireland. Dr. Johnny Geber wrote about burials at Owen Breastie over in Galway. And he had a very high level of violence at that site. It's a pretty unusual site. But he was finding examples of mutilation as well. And he wondered, was it some sort of like vengeance killing, or that this was maybe like a rival leader and they had to kind of almost physically destroy the body to sort of eradicate the claim that that person maybe or their family were making. At Ranelagh, there was another guy who'd, again, he'd been decapitated and he'd been sort of cut down in battle. You know, there were cuts on his lower legs, his arms. But then he seems to have been burned as well. There was evidence of kind of like burning, just like little patches across his skeleton. It looked to me like either he was burned on the battlefield and there were maybe hot coals or something sort of sprinkled about for whatever reason. Or we know in the historic sources that kings would have been burned in buildings at Samhain. So it was another kind of ritualistic way to kill a king. So maybe he was somebody important and they had to burn him as part of kind of eradicating his memory.
Eileen even found evidence that some of the men at Ranelagh may have been scalped.
3 or 4 of them had evidence of what I think is hair removal. So there were 3 guys who looked like they'd had sort of the skin at the back of the head sort of like slivered off. So you've just got these very kind of fine sort of slices. So it wouldn't have broken through the skull bone. It just sort of slivered off the skin and the outer layer of bone. And I think this is to do with maybe removal of a ponytail or something at the back of the skull. And with one guy then with similar sort of cuts on his chin. And maybe that was to do with removal of a beard. And again, you know, if we go to the historical sources, the Irish kind of early warriors were very proud of their hair. And you've got all these descriptions of long hair and hair being coiled around the head. And similar with the beards, you know, the beards were, could be forked or unforked. And they describe the colour. It all seems to be a very important part of the image of warriors. And then the laws tell us that there was, you know, the punishments could be dealt out if you sort of just damaged somebody's hair or even somebody's beard. And there's quite a few accounts of that. So that's what I think, it's all part of the sort of humiliating these men before they were executed. So it's pretty graphic.
The most disturbing case of violence Eileen came across was that of a youth who had been killed. Interestingly, in her analysis, she explains how this may have been an executed hostage. This is something that came up in an episode 2 weeks ago when we were talking about Aoife and Strongbow. You might remember her brother, Connor, was executed as a hostage.
There was a team of us looking at the skeletons and doing the analysis, and we were all really shocked because we found a child's skeleton who had been decapitated. We got the DNA analysis. It was a little boy, and he was only 7.5 to 9.5 when he was killed. So he had clear evidence of decapitation. He would have been in the head forward, blows dealt from behind, and that's how he would have been killed. So we found that pretty shocking, because in Ireland, you do get sort of adolescents with evidence of violence, but they're sort of around 13, 14 upwards, and that 14 seems to have been one of the ages where people started to be considered an adult. So maybe these guys are young to us, but they may have been, you know, warriors in their own right. But the little 7.5 to 9.5 year old, like he definitely would have been too young. And I think there were prohibitions against killing children. And again, we've got these in the law tract. So there would have, I think his honour price would have been half that of his father's, but it would have been, you know, a big punishment anyway to injure a child like that. So what we think may have happened was that he could have been in some sort of a hostage arrangement, because there are accounts whereby, you know, an aggressor may take, you know, a victor may take the child of, you know, a rival, and everything's fine as long as the rival plays ball and, you know, the hostage is well looked after. But if there's any sort of any deviation from the plan, then the hostage could be killed or maimed or blinded. And what better way to get at a parent, you know, than to do something to their child? So it would have been like an extreme kind of way to put down your rivals. And we do have horrible accounts, you know, of babies being killed violently, you know, in sort of socio-political conflicts. So I suppose it's a reasonable interpretation for our little boy.
Amidst this brutality, however, Eileen's analysis had led her to believe there was still a degree of care taken in the final burial of some of these people who had suffered awful deaths, which might indicate that their families had retrieved their bodies. Here she's talking about the person whose body had been burned after death.
What was interesting about him was that they seemed to have put his head on his chest and then wrapped the upper part of his body. And then he was buried in a sort of Christian manner. And that's something that, even though these guys died violently, there must have been some sort of agreement that their families could retrieve their bodies and then give them a formal burial, because, you know, they do seem to be buried, you know, in the typical Christian way with the head to the west. And, you know, we have things like heads being propped up with earmuff stones, and then, you know, that evidence of shrouding in the individual who is burned.
Discussions around violence can often render the past incomprehensible. However, Eileen was keen to point out that love, care and emotion was also evident in the burials at Ranelagh.
I mean, I just think in the burials there's so much evidence of connections, you know, and family and emotion. You know, the way that some of the burials are laid, they're laid out in very sort of particular ways, you know, and there's grave goods in with them, little pieces of quartz, and the children are sort of buried. A lot of them, they deviate from the sort of typical Christian position, and they're buried on their sides, and it's a much more casual position. And I think they were trying to replicate sleeping. So I kind of think the warfaring is one aspect, but they were ordinary people just like ourselves who loved and lost and, you know, had all these sorrows. And I think you see that really clearly in the burials.
My final question was about childhood. Traditionally, it was thought that parents maintained a distant relationship with their children in the medieval period because mortality rates were so high. Eileen pointed out, however, she found evidence of great care and attachment in the graves of young people at Ranelagh.
I see, you know, the tiniest little babies being laid out really carefully and quartz positioned around the wee bodies. And there was even a wee set of twins at Ranelagh. And to me, it looked like their hands were either right beside each other or they were entwined. And I think, again, you know, little touches like that, there's such emotion, such power, you know, and you can just imagine people being heartbroken, because you know, the cemetery, it's very interesting for us looking in, you know, as 21st century onlookers. But for each of those burials, there would have been a real sense of loss and sorrow. And I just think we have to remember that in our work as archaeologists as well. So, and it's like I say, it's all about humanizing these people and telling their stories. And that's why I think it's important that we do this type of work.
I found that conversation absolutely absorbing. My questions were all based around the publication, Roscommon's Forgotten Cemetery, Excavation Results at Ranelagh Revealed. It's available online and it's free. And also, I will say, it's a really accessible text. You don't need to be an expert to read it at all. I'd strongly recommend checking it out and finding out more about what we talked about today. I've links to that and the socials for Queen's University Belfast School of Natural and Built Environment in the show notes as well. Finally, I just want to thank Eileen for being so generous with her time. Until next week, slán.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.